are already in order.
House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. April 28th, we have a busy agenda. We'll move quickly and hopefully be as productive as we were during our last meeting. Start with a work session on House Bill 3037. Barbara, a quick summary, please.
Create the paint stewardship pilot program for the purpose of reducing the generation of post-consumer paint, promoting the reuse of post-consumer paint, and developing a process of collecting, transporting, and processing the paint in an environmentally sound fashion.
We heard good testimony about this last week from our friends in the paint industry and from Canada. We now have a revenue statement and fiscal statement. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I believe it is ready to go.
Chair.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we adopt the Dash 2 amendments?
We did.
Then, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3037 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3037 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Thatcher.
I suppose this won't be a shock, but I'm not going to be supporting it. I just resist. I think there's it's well-intended. As many things that we do in this building are well-intended. I just don't think it's time to set up a Ministry of Paint. Hold that.
Okay, thank you. If there is no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Holy.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Felicio?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is declared passed. House Bill 3037 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation and on to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3037 and open a work session on House Bill 2531. Barbara.
HB 2531 expands the purpose of the Major League Stadium Grant Fund to include the financing, developing, constructing, and furnishing of a Major League Stadium designed for use by a Major League soccer team.
I've heard this bill a few times as well. The amendments, we adopted the Dash 3s last meeting to deal with the question of spouses of employees of the soccer team. We have the revenue and fiscal statement. This bill has a prior reference or a prior referral to revenue, and I believe it is ready to go.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2531 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2531 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Representative Thatcher, noted. No other discussion or objection. Would you like to call the roll and be able to say no, or shall we just note the note your
no vote? I don't care how you
want to do it, Chair. Okay. Let's note for the record that Representative Thatcher votes no, and that the remaining members of the committee are voting aye. And House Bill 2531 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. That will close the work session on House Bill 2531. And open a work session on House Bill 3058.
HB 3058 changes the definition of applicant for purposes of the removal fill permitting program administered by the Department of Lands for the state's water resources to include persons other than landowners or their representatives.
I want to say for the, as we start a discussion here, we've had a variety of people very interested in this bill on both sides. I think some good discussion about concerns, and it's my intent that that discussion continue. I think there will be some discussion today. There have been a variety of amendments proposed that are in various states of readiness. So we'd have a quick discussion about the contents or the intents of those amendments and then conclude the work session. Is there anyone who'd like to say anything about their about the bill and the amendments that are in process? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill presents a most interesting situation and one that I've spent a great deal of time working with. And as most of you know, the idea underlying the bill was to allow those interested in creating linear projects to proceed with the application process before they initiated the condemnation process. For those of us who have constituents, and there are many, that are concerned about the property right element of this, the fear is that by allowing this amendment or this bill to pass, those who are concerned about condemnation would be losing a step. I had hoped, through working with parties on both sides, that we could create an amendment to the bill that would actually improve the property owner's interests and leave them in a position better suited to defend their rights than where they currently find themselves. I've worked with four of the pipeline companies, three of the opposition interests, and the Attorney General's office in trying to create the amendments. I've created two or three of them. Some of them are still being crafted. It is, on such short notice, impossible to tell the folks that are so interested in this that the amendments will leave them in a better position than they are in today. And by those, I mean those whose land lines may cross. And for that reason, if we were going to vote on it today as opposed to send it to rules, I would be a no vote. But I think there still is an opportunity for those who are interested in making this situation work both for the state of Oregon and for the landowners to create a parallel process or a dual process or something that protects the landowners' rights while at the same time allowing the state of Oregon to, in some fashion, help transmission that has to occur across our land and our state. It's a challenging business, I must say. And I think there is an opportunity to protect the landowner, which is my primary hope, while at the same time allowing transmission. But it's going to take a great deal more work. And so rather than try to rush through amendments today, Mr. Chair, I think it would be better that we refer the matter as I understand it, to rules.
Thank you very much. I think it will make sense to have that motion a bit later after others have a chance to say something. But let me say that I really appreciate your work on this. I think your approach is right to take the questions in a logical, dispassionate sort of approach and try to uncover what the issues are, making sure that both sides are considered. I really appreciate that. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a number of amendments around, and so I'll hold a comment on those, but I did want to make a couple of comments about this bill. And I do appreciate that this is not just an LNG bill, and I want to make sure you understand that. I understand that. For me, much of the discussion around this obviously got stuck on LNG, and so to not address it would also be a mistake. And I want to say a few words about that. But before I do that, I just want to be sure that I'm on record saying publicly that, first of all, I appreciate your leadership. I consider you a person of integrity and of openness. And the way you conducted that hearing on that bill and the others through the entire session, I think are exemplary. And I just want to be sure people know that.
Thank you. That
you've done a good job. And you know that I think there are too many bills in this session, but that's another argument. We have a lot of on our agenda, and I think you've done a good job of conducting yourself and making this an open hearing. The other thing I want to make sure I'm on record saying is that parts of this bill may divide my colleague here to my right, Representative Witt, but I also want to make sure that I'm on record publicly saying what a good representative I think he is. I understand his motivation for parts of this bill that I may disagree with or may not disagree with, because first and foremost, I know him to be somebody who cares about his district. And if you were around in 07 when the hurricane-like storm came through his district, you'd know how much he cares about the people in his district. So let us not belabor in any worthless blogs and mistake this guy for anybody who doesn't care about Oregon and about his district. So there are jobs at stake. I have jobs in my district that I'm concerned about, but there are jobs in his district, and I'm not ascribing what your motivation is other than it's a good one. And I just want to be sure we understand that. I have no quarrel with people on this panel. Now, having said that, I just want to, and I'm sorry, and I appreciate your indulgence, but I haven't said much on this, and much has been said to me. I'm leaning against this bill, and I'm interested to see what the discussion is and the possibilities for amendments and rules. But I believe that we must be honest about the debate. And for me, that means natural gas is part of our future. So whether it's in the LNG, whether it's in the pipeline, if you don't think LNG and you don't think that natural gas is part of our future, then we don't agree. Now, how you do that is important. And I believe that I'm involved in a lot of alternative energy issues, and there'll be one coming up later that I've worked closely with Representative Bailey on. But until we reach that point, we're not going to turn the lights off. And I think the cleanest petrol-based fuel that we have is natural gas. How we treat people is important, but honest debate, I think, has to include natural gas. That's my opinion. The other thing I want us to remember, and you may all think I've been, you know, smelling natural gas, but I believe we need to stand up now and in other places in this legislature for a regional preference point of view that is very similar to the way Bonneville and the hydroelectric system that undergirds our economic system was viewed in the 80s by some pretty wise senators. Hatfield and Jackson come to mind, and it was placed in the Northwest Power Act that we'd have regional preference. Now, this gas does not emanate from Oregon. I understand that. But we're taking the risk, and we're going through the issues of grabbing land and accommodating people and running it through our property. And I am not interested in this becoming an energy farm for California. So I believe regional preference should be given to Oregon. And the gas companies and the industry that's involved have assured me that it will be. And I like the figures. But I believe the federal government should step in and say, if you're going to have these LNGs, if you're going to have the pipeline, Oregon first. I think it's a bedrock principle. And lastly, the bedrock principle for me of the three is property rights. And that's why I was hopeful that Representative Thatcher's amendment would come forward, because it spells out in no uncertain terms that you deserve maximum compensation if this thing's coming through. And we better be sure that it's the right route. Because just as there are jobs on one end that I wholeheartedly support, I've got jobs in my district that could be affected by projects that are under this bill. Jobs on farms that have been around for a long time. And I've tried to listen to those folks. And those are the three things that I hope amendments will address and that this bill will take into consideration. So that's where I am, and I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Are there other comments? Representative Bailey and then Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo many of the points that my good colleagues made here, particularly with regards to the personal character and the skill of the chair and Representative Witt. I think that one of the values of this bill has been that it has done its job in the democratic sense of engaging a vigorous debate. And I think...
Small D.
And, yes, small D, democratic debate, big D. It is engaged a debate about the future of this state, both with regards to climate and the future of this state with regards to individual rights. And if this bill were to come forward today for a vote, at this point I would be a no vote on this bill. But I want to be respectful of the conversations and the thinking that is going into many of the amendments and the discussions that are happening on this bill. And I think it would be important to make sure that we weren't able to cut off that thinking.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I, too, want to echo the comments of every colleague that has spoken to this issue so far, and I appreciate that. It's just tough to balance the need for the energy with the needs to compensate adequately and well the property owners who are being affected. And we also need to make sure, ensure people. People are really worried about if you're going to go through with this application process before the land's even obtained, that somehow they just feel it's a feeling of violation that needs to be dealt with. We need to strengthen the land, the notification rules and for those seeking to legally enter the premises so that they don't feel tromped on by whatever company that could be out there possibly looking at their land for purposes of utilities, which we do need. We also need to seek a way to impact the land, the private landowner's property in the least, well, in the least impactful way, so that we search for, instead of just running straight, you know, bifurcating a plot of farmland, going around it somehow, engaging, utilizing other resources or paths that could possibly alleviate some concerns, make them whole when it comes to dealing with irrigation and tile lines. It could be possibly disrupted by placing a pipeline or other utility or road along that man, along that path. Also, having to deal with the crops, the land, you know, they're going to take the topsoil out, they're going to try to replace it, but nothing's ever the same after that. And it takes a few years to get it to grow back. There needs to be some compensation for that period of time during which that crop is trying to get reinvigorated, reestablished. Also, they also lose some flexibility in that they won't be able to plant any deep-rooted crops where they may have decided, they might have had that flexibility before. They would lose that flexibility along that path. So that needs to be considered in their compensation. They need to have it needs to be considered whether they just need to be made whole. And every little aspect needs to be looked at. I know there's a process. I've been told there's a process and precedent set for compensating people. I think that needs to be looked at. Just because it's been done before doesn't mean it's right. And I think that really needs to be looked at. And I do appreciate the discussion that's been had. And I hope we can improve the process for everybody involved when it gets to the Rules Committee. So I thank the Chair for your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative
Galizio. Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just wanted to make it absolutely clear that Representative Gilliam and myself were in no way involved in organizing or participating in the picketing in front of your home. So let's just make sure that that's clear on the record. Actually, I half-heartedly joke in the sense that that was something that happened in this process that I thought was extraordinarily unfortunate, and if anything, for future picketers, that has the opposite effect in terms of persuading people, citizen legislators, how they might vote. So I thought that was something that I just want to make sure that was on the record. In the current form, I would vote no for this bill, but as a courtesy to move it along in the process, I'll be supporting that for a lot of the reasons that were talked about. I have a different understanding of what the definition of a permit is and the significance of a permitting process. I do think there are concerns about property values, and once you do have a permit applied for on your, and it's your property, that would be make it very difficult to sell. So I think the state is in the position where it could, and this according to the Department of Justice, bear significant legal costs if the bill were to pass in its current form. So for those reasons, I'm in a position where I'm aligned with a lot of what people have already said, but will be, as a courtesy, helping to move it along to foster greater debate and discussion.
Thank you. Representative Oskoholvi, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that if I were to vote on my colleague's statement so far, I'd unanimously agree with most everything that's been said. This is a very difficult issue, and I really tried to look at the process that's involved in the permitting and the reviews and the analyses that have to take place, and it does appear to me that the process does have some problems. But at the same time, I'm very concerned about the rights of people to their own property. I'm also very concerned about our energy future. I think that, as Representative Gilliam noted, that it's pretty hard to imagine our future without natural gas right now when we still rely on coal for part of our electrical generation. But notwithstanding that, in its current form, I would also be a no vote on this bill. I have really struggled with it, and I'm very uncomfortable sending this on to another committee right now with a do-pass recommendation. So if that is the intent, I will be a no on that. Recommendation. If I will vote yes to send it on without recommendation, but I think that's an important distinction for me. And I really appreciate your leadership in discussing this issue and trying to have an open forum for the public. I also want to recognize Representative Witt and his work on this bill, because I think he makes some extremely good points that do need to be addressed, because I fear that if those points are not addressed, that the state of Oregon will lose its rights to review these processes and the analyses that need to take place by a federal court. And the federal court will then just basically say to the state of Oregon, you have no right to review these because you don't have a reasonable process. And at that point, FERC will make the decision. So I've got a lot of different concerns that are conflicting on this bill at this point. I hope that there's some more work done on it and it gets to a point where we have a bill that does everything that everybody on this committee wants it to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holby. And just to clarify before we hear from Representative Witt, my hope is that the motion will be to send it to rules without recommendation. There are a variety of concerns, as you have articulately laid out, that we don't yet know the exact form of the amendments that may emerge. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do that without recommendation. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you for hearing this bill and for your leadership on it and for the indulgence of all of my colleagues who have been part of the debate on this bill. It is really at the heart of it a simple proposal. The surrounding issues are very difficult. The definition has been expanded upon significantly in terms of what people think it does and says. And in light of that, I think it has brought to bear a lot of outside pressures that maybe are undue concerns, but nevertheless concerns. Because of that, I know that a number of you have proposed or will be proposing amendments to this bill, which I believe can only help it. I think there are a number of amendments that are on their way that will add a level of confidence and assurance to the some of the general public's concerns about this bill, particularly a notification and property rights. And to the extent that it does that, it will only help this bill and make it a much better bill. I welcome the assistance of all of my colleagues in that regard. And I would say that all of you who have engaged in a deliberative debate have reassured me and given me additional faith not only in our process but our democracy in this body as well, and I'm proud to be a part of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Witt. I think that means everybody has spoken on the bill. So I would be very interested in a motion to send it to the Rules Committee without recommendation. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, a question. Before we do that, I'm not sufficiently familiar with the process to know exactly what happens to those amendments that currently we have not yet listened to. What could you explain to us, or should we have someone come and tell us what happens to those amendments?
Representative Benz, my understanding would be that those amendments would follow the bill, and they would be the Rules Committee, should the bill travel there, would have the same ability as we would to consider those amendments, to adopt them or not. So that's my hope. I'm also a member of the Rules Committee, so it's my hope that I'll be able to work with those members who are interested in continuing to be part of the conversation to facilitate those amendments, consideration, and development. Does that answer your question?
It does. And thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue then is, for those of us who have amendments, whether we wish to take those amendments up before Rules or before this group, Is that the thinking, and the, or what is your thought there?
That's perfectly perfectly summarized. If you'd like to comment on the general nature of your proposed amendments or the amendments you're working on, that would be fine. I don't think we're in a position to adopt those amendments or take any action on them here. But if you wanted to describe generally, that's fine with me.
No, Mr. Chair, I would be most interested in the action on the amendment as opposed to the discussion today.
Okay.
So. That being the case, I'm prepared to make a motion.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3058 to the floor without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves that House Bill 3058 be passed to the floor without recommendation and referred to the Committee on Rules. One comment I would make, both as a sort of reflective comment and to our colleagues both in the legislature and in the public, is how this process has underscored to me the importance of how quickly our process moves and how quickly it changes. A lot of people, not just on this bill, and I'm guilty of it sometimes as well, will look at the bill as printed and be concerned about something that, that the bill says, not realizing necessarily that subsequent amendments have changed that, have made that irrelevant, have reshaped things in some way. So it's my hope that if this bill goes on to rules, we'll continue to engage in an open process that will allow people to collaborate, and that the people who want to involve themselves in the discussion will continue to stay up to date on how that discussion goes. Is there any other discussion on the motion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to know that under this motion that the amendments would follow. Is there anybody that's dissenting with that? I'm not doubting you. I'm just making sure that nobody has a different opinion on that, what happens. I have a couple of amendments on behalf of constituents that I would like to be heard. I have another amendment regarding a more open process, but again, as I mentioned, the concept in a possible amendment that may or may not have some relating clause issues, but the concept in Representative Thatcher's proposed amendment is extremely important to me and to the discussion. And I won't belabor here if I can put you on the spot. I'm not asking you to, you know, support or otherwise move the amendment, but as a member of the rules, I would like to know if you will work with me and help me to make sure that, the concept in Representative Thatcher's amendment is at least discussed if the bill, I assume, will be heard in rules. I'm putting you on the spot, Mr. Chair, but I want to ask you.
That's fine, Representative Gilliam. I would hope that all the issues that people have will at least be considered.
I appreciate it, because I believe her concept gets to the heart of the folks in my side of the state. And it's very important to me, and I appreciate your listening.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, now we know why he was so nice to you before.
We'll see what happens going forward, I suppose. Other discussion on the motion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. House Bill 3058 goes to the Rules Committee without recommendation. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3058 and open a work session on House Bill 3153. Representative Clem, thanks for your patience.
HB 3153 prohibits the establishment of a utility facility in an area zoned for farm use, forest use, or mixed farm and forest use if the majority of the utility service provided by the utility facility will be used within an urban growth boundary.
And as you settled, Representative Clem, we have a -2 amendment, colleagues, so that, I suspect, is going to be the subject of Representative Clem's comments. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Brian Clem, Representative House District 21 here in Central and East Salem. I also chair the House Ag, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities Committee, which is probably more about what this bill is. And actually, the underlying contents of the bill sound almost identical to what Representative Thatcher was describing. There's all kinds of language in there about crop mitigation and everything else. What I have been able to negotiate with the farmers, Farm Bureau folks, and with utilities is the -2 amendments that say that if you're meeting the criteria to be on exclusive farm use, which are already in statute, there's a series of exemptions that allow you to place utility facilities on exclusive farm use. It says basically that you then need to locate the transmission lines in consultation with the property owner and make a reasonable effort to do it in a way that least impacts their operation. And So I think a lot of what we were talking about is not quite as far as the underlying bill about crop payments and mitigation, but it is about if you're going to go through my property, talk to me, and I'll show you where I think the best places are that are the least disruptive to my operation. And as long as the utility makes a reasonable effort to consult with the person, then you know they make a determination that they where they need to put it using their eminent domain authority, and then there would be obviously some recourse in the courts if somebody came back and said, well, they didn't even consult with me, and this statute says consult with me, and they didn't. So someone will want to send a registered letter, I'm sure, confirming the consultation. But other than that, this is an effort to try and make utility transmission line sidings as least of an impact on the ongoing farming operations as possible. It's one that's got consensus among the both the utilities and the Farm Bureau, and I'm pleased to be able to bring it to you for your consideration.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Clem? I don't see. Representative Thatcher?
Love it.
Okay. We have the dash two amendments. These I think are, as you described, the consensus. I think would be Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative
Clem.
Have you seen our agenda, Representative?
I got a glimpse of it on the way in. Yeah.
Okay, and are we meeting tonight?
Is this on our agenda, Representative Gillian?
I'm just making sure.
Okay.
Are we meeting tonight?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillian, we are.
Yeah, think about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative Gillian. Is there further discussion?
It's a dilatory question.
I do have a dash three amendment which builds on the dash two amendments.
Okay.
So at the appropriate time, I would like to have them handed out and so we could consider them in conjunction with this amendment.
I think now would be a good time for that. Somewhat reminiscent of a former legislator who, when asked if he wanted to close on a bill, would say, not at this time. This seems like the right time. He said 35 minutes.
Mr. Chair, are you done with me? Senator Walker isn't, and I'm late to her committee, so if
you're excused.
All right.
Thank you.
Got to get ready for tonight.
Yeah. While they're coming forward with the amendments, Representative Benz, do you want to start describing them?
Yes, if I could have a copy, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Yes.
As they're being handed out, you'll see that the initial portion of ORS 215275 sub 2, which is found on page 1 of the dash 2 and of the dash 3 amendments, there is a sentence added to it which reads, for a utility facility that is a utility transmission or distribution line, a utility provider shall establish that each segment of the utility line is necessary for public service. And then in the second paragraph, that language follows in line 13, which reads, or for a facility that is a utility transmission or distribution line, each segment. And that language is the language that is added to that which Representative Clem mentioned, which is found on page 2 of the dash 3 amendment.
So, in essence, the dash 3 is the dash 2 plus
correct.
This segment on the first page.
That is correct.
Okay.
And the concept here is that section ORS 215.275, as written, would allow a facility to look into or hold a hearing on one end of a, let's say, a 200-mile line, and then basically have one hearing for the entire line. This amendment requires the utility to approach the matter in a segment fashion, the concept being that there are different issues along these lines, and the idea is to have a segmented approach to avoid an otherwise a single hearing process. That's how it's been explained to me. I don't think I need to speak to Representative Clem's thoughts except to note that the idea is that the transmission utility would have to work with the landowner in an effort to get along with the folks that own the land. And I'm just checking because I'm not sure that his... Yes, I'm seeing that my 4 is different than Representative Clem's 4. And so what we have to do is we would have to adopt both amendments. They're not incorporated. They don't build on each other.
Okay.
The my 4, that is the dash 3 amendment, talks just about the approach the utility must use in dealing with segments of the line as opposed to the entire 400, 300, 100, whatever the length of the line is. Representative Clem's amendment talks about the utility providers need to make a reasonable effort to work with the landowner to locate the transmission line where it will have the least practical impact. So the two are different.
Can you point to where that is? I'm having trouble.
Page 2 is on
page, yeah, page on the dash 2s, page 2, line 8.
I have, I was looking at the wrong one. Now I got it. Uh-huh. Understood. Thank you. Okay. Have you had the chance to review these dash 3 amendments with the utilities and gotten their reaction?
I have not.
Okay. We have some of those folks here. Mr. Gallagher, enlighten us. I think the dash 2s have had that sort of review. Is that true, Mr. O'Connor?
Yes. Mr. Chair?
Representative Olley.
I had one question before they get started, and maybe they can answer. The question is, I'm just kind of curious, if, and maybe Representative Bentz has an answer to this, how do we define what constitutes a segment in this discussion, I guess? I mean, it's just unclear to me exactly what would constitute somebody complying with that segment of this bill.
Mr. Representative Hopley, the answer is we don't have a definition of a segment, so I can't answer your question. All I know is what the intent was. And the intent was to preclude a transmission company from holding one hearing on one end of the line and saying that hearing was adequate for the entire line. The idea was that the line would divide into appropriate segments, whether that's by land ownership or by geographic area. The idea was that there had to be a means of addressing different segments of the line, not just the entire thing as a package. That was the idea.
Yes,
and to follow up,
thank you.
Representative Holy, the idea here, of course, was to, I think, and perhaps folks from the utilities could respond to this, there was a case that allowed, I think, the utility to hold just one hearing. And again, having just been doing the work on this over the past 2 days, I'm sure their remarks will be illustrative.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not disagreeing with the concept. I just am a little worried about the ambiguity and how that becomes enforced.
Understood. Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher representing PGE. Let me very quickly address the dash 2s and then a couple comments on the dash 3s.
Sure.
I don't think we're going to object to the dash 2s, per se. When you add new language to a statute, we are going to get different interpretations. And having been through all of the court cases on citing a facility in EFU, the court cases are probably add more detail to it than even the legislative statute. So I think we're adding something here that will change the statute. It's not completely redundant of existing law. The second thing let me say here is what I don't know, and I think we will work with the Farm Bureau and with Representative Clem on subsection 4, because I don't know what the adjudication process for this is. If you go through the siting process now, you can either choose to go through the local land use process or go through the FSEC process. If you choose to go through the FSEC process, the way that 1, 2, and 3 work, those are usually decided in the process, and the FSEC process is appealable directly to the Supreme Court. It doesn't really deal with individual pieces of property. It deals with the location of the line itself. The individual actions with the property aren't dealt with in FSEC. So I'm not sure where the landowner would would go under Section 4 if they did not come to what they thought was a conclusion with the utility. So I think that's something, as we've moved forward on this bill, we'd be happy to work with the proponents on to work out. So having said that, I understand the intent, and I did truly thought that the discussion we had on the previous bill here about the conflict between the local property owner and the overall public policy is exactly right on. And I think we're going to need to do a lot of work in the interim. We're going to have to continue to work on this process because there are truly conflicting public policies. Each and every individual landowner here has a right to object, and yet each objection will prevent the overall good from happening somehow. So I would commit us to working with the different players in the interim. On the Dash 3 amendments, those are quite sweeping. They're not simple. There was taken out when we redid this siting process to do expedited siting about 8 or 9 years ago. There used to be what's called a needs process, and it's something that you had to go in and prove there was an actual need for this facility or this particular transmission line, et cetera, at the time. When you add language to the bill like on 9 and 10 that is necessary for public service, it is most likely you have put the needs process back in the bill. So that's a problem that again, we would be very uncomfortable with unless it was a lot better spelled out. The other comment about the line segment, if the objection is to the hearing process and to the overall public process, I don't think any utility would have objection to clarifying the public process. And if there's somebody holds a rump hearing and one in the line, that's not working. And I can tell you that what's happening now in the Idaho Power process is they're starting over from scratch. They've wasted a whole lot of their money. And companies that are going through siting right now and have been through siting in the past spend a lot of time and attention in that public process. So this segment concept, I don't know what that means. If you're going from point A to point B with a transmission line, how do you can segment that line, segmenting it by property owner and having a need standard for every property owner would probably just be an unworkable process. On the Section 4, in the way the language is written, we do prefer the Section 4 in the Dash 2 amendments than in the Dash 3 amendments. I think they're going to the same direction, but they're stabilizing the remainder of the track. I think, again, that it is reasonable to have some sort of a process here where we all sit down and begin to deal with what are the particular reimbursable needs, as Representative Thatcher have said, of an individual property owner. And we're going to need some objective process to do this, I think, in the future. So in conclusion, in doing this quickly, the Dash 3s I think we would oppose, and the Dash 2s I think we can support. We'll continue to, if possible, to make those work for everybody.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. Just briefly, we provide both water and electric service to our communities, and in many cases, you may not know that, in many cases that includes service to areas outside the urban growth boundary as a sort of result of historical artifacts, but we do provide that service both inside and outside our city limits. Obviously, also our communities provide water and sewer. I'd just like to echo the comments of Mr. Gallagher. I think that you all have had a discussion here today and have had a lot of other discussions about the policy issues, and I think they really are important, and I would echo the need to spend a little time on this, more than a little time on this, during the interim. We do, as electric utilities, have a duty to serve. We have to provide that power to our communities, and it has to get there somehow. And we are I think as we have changed the public policy of moving beyond large central station facilities to more distributed generation, a lot more renewables, it accentuates the very real concerns of folks out there who where lines are going to pass over their property. It's a real difficult issue. We recognize that. About 6 years ago, we went through a long process to try to get the statute to where it is now. I don't think utilities were happy with it. I know that, and a lot of landowners weren't happy with it. I do hope that we'll spend some time. I don't want to create a false impression. I would not say that we are comfortable with the dash twos. We would be happy to continue to work on them, I wouldn't say that we support them at this time, or that there's, at least on our part, a feeling that they're okay. We do still do have some questions about them. But we'd be happy to work as part of whatever process goes forward from here. Appreciate your work on this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Flicker.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, representing the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association, and I just want to echo the comments that have been made so far by my colleagues up on the witness stand, but also to remind you that co-ops serve 65% of the state geographically, so a lot of this does impact our service territories. Also, that cooperatives are owned by their customers. That's the cooperative business model. So consulting with our customers and making sure our customers are happy is incredibly important to an electric cooperative. So that is a typical way that we do business. However, I also can't say that we support or oppose either one of these amendments. We'd be glad to continue further discussion, but I have to share my frustration that I haven't seen these amendments. They've been difficult to get our hands on, and so being able to send them to our members, there wasn't enough time to do that. So I need to go back and send these to my members for review, and would be glad to and look forward to any continued discussions on these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Don't see any.
Thank you. So we have the dash twos and the dash threes in front of us. Representative Benz.
Chair, thank you. In the interest of time, if it meets with the approval of the committee, I would hold my dash three amendment until, in the hope that this matter might be referred to rules, but I would be happy to move the dash twos.
Very good. We do have the approval from the Speaker's office to send this on to rules. I don't want this to be the pattern we set for the rest of our remaining time together, sending things to rules. But it appears that this one too is close. So I would certainly be inclined to favor that approach.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the House 3153-2 amendments dated April 27th, 2009.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the adoption of the dash two amendments to House Bill 3153 dated April 27th. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the dash two amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, then I move the House Bill 31.
In fact, I'm sorry to interrupt. I should have mentioned we don't, unfortunately, have the fiscal and revenue statements on these given the late arrival of the amendments. So we'll first need to suspend the rules in order to send the bill on to the Rules Committee without possession of those two documents. Is there any objection to suspending the rules for the purposes of sending it to the Rules Committee? I don't see any. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, then I move House Bill 3153 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3153 to the floor with due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? None. Motion is adopted. House Bill 3153 goes to the Committee on Rules. Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 3153. And open a work session on House Bill 3038.
committee. This is a we're hoping simply to move this bill on also to the Rules Committee for use, potential use for another purpose.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3038 to Rules Committee without a recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Glizio moves House Bill 3038 to the floor without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion? I don't see any.
What are they going to do with it?
I've been caught. This is going to happen probably a couple of times on the last day here. We first need to suspend the rules in order to make that move without the fiscal or revenue statements. Is there any objection to suspending the rules for the purposes of sending 3038 to the Rules Committee? I don't see any. Do we need to have Representative Leesia restate his motion?
That would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3038 to the floor via the Rules Committee without recommendation.
Representative Glizio moves House Bill 3038 to the floor without recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 3038 goes to the Committee on Rules without recommendation. And with that, close the work session on House Bill 3038 and open a work session on House Bill 2579. Barbara.
HB 2579 amends ORS 509.216 to allow the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to permit the commercial fishing of salmon in the Columbia River by fixed fishing gear or seines. Modifies ODFW's fish food management policy to include the responsibility of ensuring that the natural runs and genetic diversity of anadromous fish.
Thank you. This is the bill we've also had a lot of activity and discussion on. We have Dash 1 amendments. These are amendments that I requested, and they serve to create a task force that is in line with the discussions we've had. I would point out a couple of things about it that are different from other groups that have convened for similar purposes in the past. One is that the task force will have members of the legislature as part of the task force. Two is that a professional mediator will be part of the task force. And third is a provision that says, it's on page 4 of the Dash 1 Amendment, section 3, that if the task force does not submit, I'm reading, a consensus report to the interim legislative committees by January 1st, 2011, the State Fish and Wildlife Commission, in implementing the salmon allocation formula, shall reduce Lower Columbia River salmon allocation by an amount that is between 30 and 40% for the calendar years 2011 and 2012. So it's my hope that this will serve to motivate those involved with the task force to come to an agreement. I'd be interested in your comments or discussion. Representative Gilliam.
You would?
Sure. I might regret having said that after you talk, but for now.
Before we move on, just for the record, I think Representative Benz's amendments, or I mean motions, have a lot more confidence than the other guy.
Mr. Chair, this is my bill, and you know, in a few minutes, on 2940, the relating clause is going to be my friend. Sometimes the relating clause is not your friend. So you and I have talked about this, and you know I don't think this is the way to go. And I don't doubt your motive. I hope that if it passes, and I will be voting against it, that the provisions that you put in take the discussion to another level. But you and I do not have the context of the many years that folks have discussed this issue.
You remember that comment from the 1888 report.
Yeah, okay. Well pointed out. But my sports fishermen have convinced me that this is not the way to go. And so I'll be voting no. And I mean no disrespect, I would also disassociate myself from the bill, totally understanding that relating clauses are what they are at this point in the session.
Understood. Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Further discussion? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the long-running debate over these issues, then I think it may make sense to ensure that we have a robust discussion during the interim. I would like to put on the record, though, that I have been impressed by many of the ideas that have been put forward in ways to refine salmon harvest practices, particularly that were in the some of the Safe for Salmon proposals, and I'd hope that those ideas are incorporated into the discussions in the task force.
Absolutely. Thank you for the comment, Representative Bailey. It's my hope that should this pass, there would be, I think I'm safe to say, nothing off the table during that discussion. And indeed, that's the purpose that I envision for the task force, to have that discussion in which all the various ideas and approaches would be discussed. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have long looked forward to all fishers, both commercial as well as sport, coming forward with a united proposal on how we are going to do fish allocations, and I suspect that your Dash 1 amendments will help accommodate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. How many task forces have there been on this particular subject?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can say with confidence that they have not, the ones, I don't believe there are any that have been authorized in statute, and those that have proceeded have not had, at least in the understanding I have from those who participated in this discussion generally, have not had legislative representation as part of the task force. They've also, I'm quite confident, not had the incentive that's contained in Section 3. So I would not be so naive as to suggest this is an entirely new approach that has never been tried before, but I think it has some new elements that give it a chance for success.
I'm all for locking these folks in a room and just making them come out with something that works. And I'm not sure that the makeup of this committee, just because you've got such diverse groups of sportsmen people, but you have a pretty cohesive group, I think, I've observed anyway. I could be wrong, of commercial people. And I'm wondering if the makeup is really going to produce what
I think it's a legitimate
or wanting.
And I would just suggest the Speaker and the Senate President will be jointly appointing those members. And I suspect that both of those individuals would be open to our observations and recommendations as to who the members might be. I'm planning on availing myself of that opportunity, and I'm certainly happy to conduct your recommendations or observations as well, or help facilitate an opportunity for you to do that. I think it does depend greatly on who those individuals are who are going to participate in it, and it's also my hope that the mediator who is going to be part of this task force will have an opportunity to consult with the Speaker and the Senate President as the membership is formed, so that we can try to identify the right people to help carry that process forward.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to add that I pray I do not serve on this task force.
That might well be part of your recommendation. Understood.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Not it.
Other comments? I would. I suppose it's okay for the chair to move his own amendments, right?
Yeah.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2579. Is there any discussion? I can do that, I think.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me a moment to comment. I asked for an assurance, and I'm glad that I've gotten that assurance, so I'll be supporting the bill going forward.
What? Understood. Is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments? Seeing none, Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Galizio, would you like to move?
Yes, with supreme confidence.
We have here, now you can
really do it. Can read the script?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves House Bill 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none. House Bill 2579 is to the floor. Representative Gilley, you object. Very good. We can take a roll call vote, please.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Vice Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Delezio?
Aye.
Chair
Reed. Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed. House Bill 2579 goes to the floor with due pass recommendation and to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2579 and open a.
He's got to leave for just a minute.
Let's see how many.
They have two. Transportation.
Still keep going.
Yeah.
If you want. Sure.
Yeah.
Open a work session on House Bill 3158.
Okay.
Let's see, Representative Smith here.
Okay.
Please come on.
Okay. 3158. Found it. HB 3158 establishes the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, requires the governor to appoint the all-volunteer council, delineates the council's representation, term length, and members and general operational rules.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We've been working closely with the governor's office. It's important for the governor to have a coordinated strategy for broadband in Oregon. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 State House. Forgive me. To have a coordinated strategy for broadband in Oregon as we move to address the digital divide. I remember from the last time we testified, Representative Gilliam made the excellent point we got to make sure we're addressing rural communities, and I think by addressing broadband, that would be among the highest priorities and is explicitly provided for. Also, the group will have close ties to the legislature with ex officio legislative members. For purposes of fiscal impact, in part, it's an all-volunteer council. That has an ancillary benefit, at very least silver lining, of being well-placed and well-positioned to advocate for the public interest in these matters. The asking today that we move it forward through the process. Happy to answer questions. I believe that the hope is to address the Dash 5 amendments, and I know you have a lot of other business, so I can continue to talk if you'd like me to.
Maybe you could just remind us of what the Dash 5 amendments do or how it changes the bill from its original form.
Happy to do that. Three primary changes. It addresses the whereas language, stressing the importance of broadband and specifying the mission of the group. It removes the authority to appropriate federal money. That will remain in the rulemaking group that the governor is putting together in the legal interface, and it readjusts the composition of the group in the following ways. Instead of specifying service providers, we wanted to give the governor latitude to choose which type of providers need to be represented as technology develops. And instead of identifying specific sectors or organizations, we wanted to broaden representation to represent public interest outcomes mentioned earlier: education, economic development, public safety, health, and e-government. So one of the challenges, and I'll say just a moment about this because it's a hobby horse, one of the challenges we have, I think, in our system of governance is that most power is organized not around objectives but around constituencies. And we try to mobilize and cobble together these constituencies in order to put together objectives. Where possible, it seems like it might be helpful for us to set important objectives and build constituencies around those objectives.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Apparently you've done such a good job that no one has any questions. I assume, I'm looking at the revenue and fiscal statements we have at the end, that part of the reason those don't appear to have many numbers in them is that this group will be meeting with video conferencing and other broadcast technologies.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, members of the committee.
Sure. We have Dash 5 amendments and fiscal and revenue.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 3158, dated April 24th, 2009.
Thank you. Representative Blasio moves the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 3158, dated April 24th. Are there any comments or discussion?
I don't see any.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, Dash 5 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3158 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Glezio moves House Bill 3158 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. House Bill 3158 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 3158. And we see Representative Edwards.
Oh, wait, I don't have any more. So, 2952. Oh, yeah, I got the tools here.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll open a work session on House Bill 3056.
HB 3056 amends statute relating to urban renewal plans and their maximum amount of indebtedness that may be issued or incurred under the plan. Requires 50% of increment to be added to the total assessed value of property within an urban renewal area, and whenever increment equals total assessed value.
So we've heard this bill before as well. This is the urban renewal discussion, and we heard the introduction. Three people who are here to give us an update. We now that we have the amendments, Harvey Rogers, Alec Jensen, Doug Rux. This time I pronounce Mr. Rux your name correctly, I think. So we have the dash five amendments. Those are the ones that you're speaking to.
Yes, Chair Reed, committee members, Doug Rux, president of the Association of Oregon Renewal Agencies. The Dash 5 amendments before you today, we gave you a briefing a couple of weeks ago. The amendments are here, incorporate those provisions that we have presented to you. Briefly recapping that is that there are some governors on the maximum indebtedness amounts that can be set. There are three tiers established with that. Secondly, is that if you do a substantial amendment, that there is a 20% allowance to increase the maximum indebtedness amount through the conferred consult. Above that 20%, it requires a 75% concurrence of the overlapping taxing districts based upon the foregone revenues. There's some housekeeping amendments that are associated into the amendment as well. In the return of value component back to the overlapping taxing districts, which was part of the big discussions that we had over the course of 4 months. That's just kind of a brief recap of what's in the Dash 5.
Thank you very much. Do you gentlemen have comments or here to answer questions? Very good. Are there any questions?
Okay.
I don't see any. Thank you very much. So the Dash 5 amendments are you're all satisfied with the Dash 5s. They represent the consensus of the group.
Chair, members of the committee, they came out yesterday. It's a very long bill. They seem to be aligned with the materials we submitted to Legislative Council. We may have comments on the Senate side.
Okay, understood. Good. Mr. Vance, we're on 3056, the Dash 5 amendments. These gentlemen have just indicated they're ready to go. Representative Gilliam, are you seeing
a quick
initiative?
Sorry. Sorry,
your hand.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. Okay. That doesn't mean you have to leave. But
no, I'm right here.
Okay, good. I'd be interested in the motion on the Dash 5 amendments. Then.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3056.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3056. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 5 amendments are adopted, House Bill 3056. We need to, again, suspend the rules. We don't have the fiscal and revenue, but confident based on the conversations we've had that this will not generate that and that it can go right to the floor. So is there any objection to suspending the rules for the purpose of sending House Bill 3056 to the floor? I don't see any.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Is it, you may have said this, but I was trying to absorb what they said. They're speaking some other language, aren't they? But is there expected to be any fiscal impact on local communities or... probably not state government, but this deals with local communities. I'm just wondering.
I would be reluctant to answer that question because I have had a little bit of exposure to that other language. I don't speak it fluently, so maybe we can ask these gentlemen.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, what this bill provides basically is a limit on the amount of time an urban renewal district may remain in existence. And when the urban renewal district matures to the point where it's doing fairly well,
it gives value back to overlapping taxing districts. So the principal fiscal impact is that value is shared and available to be taxed by overlapping taxing districts. There's an indirect benefit to the state in that because it increases the amount of money that goes to schools and reduces the state's the pressure on the state to backfill those things. So urban renewal districts collect somewhat less money over time, and other governments receive more as a result of that.
I appreciate the translation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So seeing no objections, we will proceed.
I had no objections, just
okay.
Comment.
Go ahead.
I really appreciate the work that everybody's done in coming together and looking at this issue. It's been an issue that's been a concern of mine in my community for quite some time, and I recognize the, as the gentleman noted, that this does have an impact to our state revenues for schools, and also has an impact to revenues going to other taxing districts. It's a concern of mine that many of these urban renewal districts, left unchecked, would continue to grow, and restricting money from taxing districts in the state and our state school funds. So I really appreciate the work that's been done to try to put some parameters around urban renewal districts. I think the bill's long overdue. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Having heard that, rules are suspended for the purposes of House Bill 3056. Representative Galizio.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3056 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves House Bill 3056 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. House Bill 3056 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Call has asked to carry the bill, and seeing no objection from this group, will Representative Call carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3056 and open the work session on House Bill 3300. Saw Representative Edwards come in. Representative Chris Edwards is not on this one. Representative David Edwards, I saw somewhere back there. Hopefully he's out in the hall somewhere and on his way back in.
We've been calling him.
I saw him momentarily.
Oh, did you?
Yes, he was here. So let's hear the summary again, and we'll hope he appears. 3300, House Bill 3300.
HB 3300 instructs the State Workforce Investment Board to develop a plan for an initiative to promote the growth of green jobs.
Thank you. Well, there he is, right on cue. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. For the record, my name is David Edwards. I'm the state representative from House District 30, which encompasses Greater Hillsborough and North Plains in Washington County. As you may or may not have before you, there is a -4 amendment to the bill, which essentially adjusts the language that was in Section 7 to ensure that there is no fiscal attached to the bill, and again verifies that the governor's office will be responsible for paying the costs associated with sections 2 through 6. There was some discussion after the introduction of the bill about this specific language that would direct the governor to pay for those costs. And so this language is more suitable to the governor's office, but it has the same effect and should remove the fiscal attached to the bill.
Very good. Any questions for representatives? Don't see any. So your recommendation is to adopt the amendment and then we'll be sending it to Ways and Means?
That would be my preference.
Okay. And I apologize, I was saying something else to me. We have -1s and -2s in front of us. Did we already adopt one of those?
We have adopted the -1s and the -2s, and we need to receive the -2s.
Okay.
And I have the script. to say, and then adopt the bill as amended.
So adopt the bill as amended by -1, but not -2.
Correct.
Is that correct? Then
correct.
Then it goes to Ways and Means, where the amendment that Representative Edwards described might be added.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Very good. Is there any discussion before we undertake that?
Chair Bass needs to start working.
It's his turn?
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
No, I don't have a script.
Mr. Chair. I don't seem to have the dash fours, so it's going to be difficult to move them.
So, no, I think what we're going to do, Representative Betts, is recede the dash twos, then move the bill to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, where the amendments that we don't have will be added to accomplish a similar intent to what we tried to do, but with superior wording. Is that a reasonable way to describe it?
With your indulgence, Mr. Chair, yes. The intent of the dash four is merely to change the wording so it's more suitable to all the parties involved.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
is this the way I see Representative Gilliam speaking?
Okay. Twos are not coming. We don't have them.
We have them. In fact, we adopted them. We're going to take them out because of the unintended effect they had.
Okay. So we're going to vote on taking them out.
That's the first step.
Can I ask Representative Edwards a question?
Please.
Representative, were twos at some point going to address how much the governor was willing to put into this from the executive department? Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes. The initial intention was that there would be a specific dollar amount specified. In discussions with the governor's office, they have agreed to pay the cost, dispersing money at the direction of the governor. That is available via the Workforce Investment Act dollars from the federal government.
And again, this, if we take this route, it will go to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, where the specific dollar amounts can be. Yes.
Can anybody give me just a ballpark of what we're talking about?
Representative Edwards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I believe that the only cost that would be incurred would be the staffing costs for the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. We're probably talking about $250,000 or less. Thank you.
Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3300-2 amendments dated April 20th, 2009 were adopted.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves that we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3300 dated April 20th were adopted. Is there any objection or any discussion or any objection? I don't see any. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3300 as amended. Actually, I guess it would be as reconsidered and amended to the floor with a...
To
be referred to Ways and Means. And do we include a recommendation or with a due pass or with no recommendation?
I think, Representative Benz, you're moving that House Bill 3300 as reconsidered and amended only by the Dash 1 amendments be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the committee and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
That is correct.
Very good. We'll get through this. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, do you want to point out for the record that this will be a courtesy vote and reserve my...
Understood.
Possibility of voting no on the floor.
Understood. Anyone else? Representative Gilliam?
Is this discussion on the bill?
This is on the motion to send the bill as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor and to Ways and Means.
I'll save mine for the bill.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah. That.
What he said.
Yeah.
Understood. Okay. Is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. House Bill 3300, as amended by the Dash 1 amendments, goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation and on to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
I close the work session on House Bill 3300. And open a work session on House Bill 2940. Barbara.
HB 2940 allows a biomass electricity generating facility to comply with the renewable portfolio standard under certain conditions.
Thank you. We have Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments in front of us. Have we adopted, we've adopted the Dash 2 amendments last time, is that correct?
We adopted the 2s and 3s.
2s and 3s. Okay, so we were just waiting on the fiscal and revenue.
Which we unfortunately don't have. No.
So we have a revenue impact.
We do. We do not have a fiscal. We've been waiting. And the option, unfortunately, would be to suspend the rules unless we want to just put that at the bottom of the pile and wait until more like 3 o'clock.
Okay. Let's apologize for opening it a little prematurely. I thought we had that. So let's close work session and wait and see if we can cover the fiscal before we have to adjourn. So close the work session on House Bill 2940. And
yes.
Yeah. No work session on House Bill. Actually, we need to do a public hearing.
Yes,
first.
We do.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2952.
HB 2952 adds a requirement that an applicant filing to obtain loan funds from the State Department of Energy for a small-scale local energy project include proof that any necessary electrical, plumbing, or other permits have been obtained for the project. Applies on the effective date of this act.
Thank you. I think Mr. Ledger wanted to be heard on this one. I see some sign-up sheet come this direction, but I want to get started, please. Andy, please come forward.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very glad to see Andy Ginsberg come in here because he's the only one, except for possibly a person sitting to my right, that understands the language in this. This is about, I'm going to be very brief. I just want to thank the chair. This took quite a bit of doing. The problem is simple. We believe this solves the problem that you'll hear about. But the language was had to be very carefully worded and involved DOJ, DEQ, LC, and certainly the people that were involved in this on the private side. And so with that, I'd like to just finish it up and you can move on. Pam.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Wood. I'm a partner at the Stoll Reeves Law Firm, where I focus on air permitting law, an esoteric specialty. And in the context of doing that work, we found that there is this one flaw in the Oregon Air Act that creates a problem for small local renewable energy facilities to get cited. And this is a joint effort between private side and the agency to try and address this flaw in as narrow means as possible. And we're happy to get into the technical details of it, but it is mind-numbing. If you want me to, though, I'm happy to do so.
Let's start with the less mind-numbing. Mr. Ginsberg.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Ginsberg with DEQ. And I'll just say that DEQ doesn't have a problem with this amendment. Happy to answer any questions if you have about how it operates.
So in the discussion or the description that I've heard, it sounds like this has been motivated at least in part by a specific scenario. Could any of you talk about that, please? Or even a hypothetical one.
Yeah. The typical scenario that you've got here is if you have areas called non-attainment areas or maintenance areas, it's places where there used to be air quality problems. Typically, you'll have a city, and there'll be some small locus of where the air is particularly impacted. When you bring in a small local renewable energy facility, you don't tend to put it right smack dab downtown where the air is at issue. You tend to put it somewhere else. And if you have any sort of physical barrier between the two locations, then it becomes difficult to show that this new facility that has to show a net ambient air quality benefit is actually benefiting the area where it's going to be located when it buys reductions in the area that's actually impacted. So this incents those new facilities to buy reductions in air quality, or I shouldn't say reduction in air quality, reductions in emissions, improvements in air quality in those areas that actually have the bad air quality.
So, in most cases, are those two areas that you describe nearly adjacent to each other?
They'll oftentimes be adjacent, but there'll be some sort of physical contour that ends up cutting them off. You do a very complex model that takes into account that topography, and if you have even just a small physical mass there, it can end up showing that, we're getting improvements in air over here, but they don't directly overlap with the impacts from the facility.
Thank you.
Oftentimes, that's not an issue at all, and we put in lots of safeguards to make sure the DEQ could review and ensure that no project that came in would actually cause a problem.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm at the very fuzzy edges of my understanding, so let me see if I've got this right. So essentially, it's like a hypothetical scenario. Let's say you have a Portland metro area. It's a non-attainment area, and you want to improve air quality within that area, and you want to site an energy facility in order to improve that air quality. Under the SELP program, you get a loan, do a small-scale energy project, and you're doing it just outside the airshed or maybe on the other side of a range or something. It does have associated benefits in that attainment area, but as the law is currently written, you can't credit that facility towards the non-attainment area, and this would allow you to do that? Is that...
Actually, it's a little different from that.
Okay.
If I want to come in and do a small-scale renewable energy facility, I have to buy credits. These credits are reductions. So if John to my left is a facility that's been operating in that area, I would go in and put controls on John so that his emissions went down. Mm-hmm. If we have a little mountain range between us or a hill between us, we're going to see great improvements where John is, but those won't actually get modeled visually. When you model them, you won't be able to show that they overlap from the impacts where my facility is located. And that's what currently the law requires, is that you show an absolute overlap between the decrease here and my increase here. Now, I'm always required by the law to get a bigger decrease than my increase, hence the net air quality benefit. So we always have that requirement, but it's just a difficult, this comes down to a modeling issue, a computer modeling issue, as you try and demonstrate how those impacts overlap. Is it my impacts, his benefits?
Mr. Chair, I think the take-home from that explanation was that this law would apparently reduce John's emissions.
Yes, and that's always a good thing.
And so I'm very much in favor of this.
I wondered about that, too. any questions? Any further questions?
Briefly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Credits. Could you explain that real quick?
Yeah, a credit is where I go into somebody, and again, I'll use John as our example, and he may be emitting at a certain level of emissions today because he doesn't have the state-of-the-art pollution control equipment. So if I want to come into an area that is limited in terms of air quality, I can ask him to put on control equipment, I pay for it, and then I reduce his emissions by maybe 50 tons so I can come in and have an increase of 25 tons. The net air quality benefit, which is what this addresses, is how one computes the fact that we've had a greater decrease as opposed to my increase. It always has to be a greater decrease, but it's how you match up those impacts. But the offsets, the credits, are that reduction that is put into a permit and that is required of that other facility. John.
Fascinating. Okay, thanks.
It's the weird world that Andy and I live in.
Representative
Witt? I'm lost for words, Mr. Chairman. I just hope that the legislature is not involved in selling John's, but anyway.
Understood. We must be near the end of our agenda, huh? Okay, so the Dash 4 amendments are before us. We would be prepared to move on those. Is it your understanding these, you mentioned before, Andy, that DEQ doesn't have any issues with this. Is it also fair to suggest that this meets the concerns you have? You'd be prepared to implement this and it works?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, very good. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to 2952.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments, House Bill 2952, dated April 24, 2009. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 4 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Chair, I move House Bill 2952 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2952 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Objections? Hearing none, motion carries. House Bill 2952 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Now comes the real question. Who'd like to carry this esoteric bill?
Freshman?
Oh, no.
I'll carry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby, thank you very much. Representative Holby will carry House Bill 2952. At that, close the session on House Bill 2952.
Only if I can join on report.
No, but he's going to take a few minutes.
Okay, so we can move on to our public hearing.
We don't put some fuel burning.
I can work fuel burning into
this.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 3476.
I will do it.
HB 3476 establishes a pilot program for the purpose of encouraging partnerships between public, private, and community entities for school renovation projects.
Thank you. I have some people coming forward as if they want to be heard. We don't yet have the... Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey, and I have the honor of representing House District 42, Inner East Side, Portland. The bill before you today, House Bill 3476, is the result of a collaboration, a public-private partnership that has resulted in a conversation around bringing our schools and our school facilities into the 21st century. Essentially, House Bill 3476 establishes a fund that provides revolving loans for school districts. It also encourages public-private partnerships on school sites. The reason here is that it gives people a stake in the schools that are around them and allows for these partnerships to make sure that our schools and are able to meet the standards that are going to be necessary in a multimodal world, in a world where schools are integrating more than just education facilities, but that are really a focal point for our community. And House Bill 3476, we have a dash one amendment in front of you that would have removed the fiscal on the bill. Unfortunately, because of the late nature of the process, we weren't able to get this together in time to move it today. But what we wanted...
Do you have copies of that, Dash One? We don't have it.
I'm not aware, Mr. Chair.
Maybe you can just describe them, just so you know we don't have them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can describe the Dash One amendments, Mr. Chair, but I think the larger point is that House Bill 3476 tees up what I think is going to be a very important conversation related to a number of bills that are before this body this session. We heard an amendment to House Bill 3444 last week. There is a bill in front of our Land Use Committee, all of which bring together a package around school siting and making sure that we have schools that are integrated in the fabric of our communities. And I think this will be an extremely important conversation for the interim, and I hope that House Bill 3476 will initiate these conversations so that we can come to a partnership solution.
Thank
and with
you,
that,
Representative
I'll
Bailey.
Turn it over to some of the proponents here.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chris Dudley. I reside at 7893 Olney Street Southeast in Salem, Oregon. I am serving as the co-chair of the Center for Innovative School Facilities, and I appear before you today in support of House Bill 3476 as proposed for amendment by the Dash One amendments. The Center for Innovative School Facilities was launched in January of 2008. It offers real estate facility development support to Oregon's school districts through technical assistance, through workshops and training across the state, through the development of financing alternatives and policy development. We've assembled teams of volunteer facility experts to deliver site-specific recommendations in Cook County Schools, the Reynolds School District, Gaston, Oregon Schools for the Deaf and the Blind, and the David Douglas School District. Currently, the center is working with a group of 20 districts from across the state, from Hermiston to Seaside and Clackamas to Roseburg, participating in a pilot project for long-range facility planning that helps schools be the centers of their community. Through our work, we have seen school districts struggle to find the money to cover basic maintenance. Oregon is one of the few states in the nation that does not have a statewide school facility program that offers technical assistance or financial support to its districts. We're trying to remedy this situation by bringing together private, public, and community partnerships, both for planning and for funding. Nationally, there's a trend for mixed and shared-use school facilities. In fact, virtually every award-winning project in the past several years, you look across the nation, has been a shared-use facility. By combining schools with community centers or public libraries or health clinics or senior housing, schools have been able to transform themselves into centers of community. Multiple uses, the increased efficiency of land use, and multiple equity partners allow schools to continue to be sited within existing communities and use funding from more than just the local school bond. The multiple use gives everyone a stake in the school property and keeps the community there and involved. We need to be encouraging shared-use facilities in Oregon. Portland has a nationally recognized example of this in the Portsmouth neighborhood called Rosa Parks. So one of the lessons we learned from Rosa Parks in that development was that these projects require more time and more money in the planning process. And it requires the involvement of people that are experienced in the packaging of these deals. It's fairly complicated to get all of the parties together and to move forward in these projects. House Bill 3476, with the Dash 1 amendments, establishes a fund and authorizes the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to access those funds and work with local community efforts. The fund is not being allocated any money under the Dash 1 amendments. We understand the fiscal plight you're in. We are establishing it in anticipation of finding a funding source in the future. We're pursuing funding sources, both public and private, and we continue to work with our national partner to advocate for future federal stimulus and allocations for school facilities. Once there's funding, the Oregon Economic Community Development Department can begin a pilot project with three school districts chosen from a competitive process that ensures diversity of the districts. These districts will receive funds and technical assistance for pre-development planning for public and private community partnership projects. The funds would be revolving, so future projects will be funded as the original loans are paid back. Finally, I'd like to thank Representative Bailey for his work to get school facilities issues heard. Representative Bailey has recognized the role that facilities play in the education of our children and the vitality of our communities. We ask for your support of this bill with the Dash 1 amendments and the future opportunities that it will provide us in helping to assist local communities in these development projects that include school facilities with other kinds of service providers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Ruth Scott. I reside at 610 Southwest Alder in Portland, and I'm here to read into the record a letter of support from Jim Mabbitt, and I also have his authority to answer any questions that you might have. This letter was emailed to your clerk earlier today. I'm writing in support of House Bill 3476 with the Dash 1 amendments. This bill would create a mechanism and authorization for a pilot project addressing the need for greater emphasis on mixed-use and shared-use school facilities. As superintendent of the Northwest Regional Education Service District and chair of the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts, I see firsthand the results of decades of deferred maintenance here in Oregon. In my ESD and across the state, our students are being held back by inadequate school facilities and in some cases spend their days in dangerous situations. Because of passing a bond is the only way to fund school facilities in Oregon, many districts are not able to generate facility revenue. In the last decade, only 25% of Oregon schools have even attempted to go out for bond. The rest rely on overworked facility staff to continue making do. Across the country, school districts are turning to partners to help make up for the lack of adequate funding. Making our schools mixed or shared use will create a number of benefits. Schools will have multiple uses that bring all community members to the school site, not just the parents. Schools with a partner have a better equity position, allowing them more options when purchasing land. And carefully chosen partners can expand programmatic capabilities. By renovating or building schools so that they act as centers of community, they're able to reach out to a constituency beyond the parents and position themselves to go out for bond on a project that supports the whole community. Thus, all community members will be familiar with facility conditions and have a stake in keeping them up. The pre-development process for the projects, including schools, is longer, more expensive, more complicated, and most multi-owner projects that are out there today. The revolving loan fund would give schools the financial ability to pursue these projects and the program at the OECDD, Oregon Economic Community Development Department, would provide them the technical assistance needed to be successful. Thank you for the hearing on House Bill 2476 and its amendments. I look forward to discussing these issues with you in the future.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? I don't see any. Appreciate you bringing the idea forward. Appreciate the comments about
the economic situation we're dealing with. I think it's an interesting idea, one that deserves further consideration. I'm glad you'll be continuing that conversation as we go into the interim and toward the next session. That, appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing unless anyone else wants to be heard on House Bill 3476. I don't see any. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3476 and open a public hearing on a work session on House Bill 2940.
HB 2940 allows a biomass electricity generating facility to comply with the renewable portfolio standard under certain conditions.
We have a fiscal now. We have already adopted the amendments. We now have fiscal and revenue. And whose turn is it for a motion?
Thanks.
Representative Bentz, I think we're ready for a motion.
Do we have amendments?
We adopted the amendments during our last meeting. We adopted that two amendments, which limited the biomass facilities to those located in the state, and we adopted the Dash 3 amendments, which deal with hydrogen power stations. Those were Representative Gilliam's amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2940 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Vince moves House Bill 2940 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the hour is late, but I just want to, again, mention that sometimes the relating clause is your friend. And this is one of those times. And I'm sorry that Representative Chris Edwards isn't here, because I wanted to express my appreciation to him for allowing me to put our amendment into this bill. I'll let him address on the floor the potential he sees in the biomass part, and I'll talk more on the floor as well, as I hope Representative Bailey will join me. But I'm very excited about this next step. I think these are the kind of moves that will bring us closer to an alternative energy future that everybody can agree with. And I thank you, Chair, for your work and help on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. I did receive a note from Representative Edwards. His absence should not be reflected as anything related to the bill. He had to go to a parent-teacher conference in Eugene. So appreciate his diligence on that front as well. Further discussion on the bill, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief note to echo Representative Gilliam's comment and to thank him for his work on advancing the hydrogen idea. One of the things that we've heard the state economist Tom Petoskey talk about is how one of the ways that we're going to pull out of the recession here in Oregon is by promoting innovation and allowing for new technologies and new ideas to come forward, I think, is very beneficial to the long-term economic future of this state.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. Further discussion?
Just when Representative Edwards was here and he was testifying on this bill, I thought, wow, this is really something I could sign on to, and I was actually excited for a bill in this committee. And so, I love the amendments that Representative Gilliam was able to get to work with the relating clause, and I think it's a great bill. And I'm glad we're passing this out of the committee and sending it to the floor, I hope.
Yes, that's the intent, and that is the motion. Don't see any further discussion. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Motion is adopted. House Bill 2940 goes to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. As it is Representative Edwards' bill, I suspect we should let him carry it. Though
he's not here.
Yes, it's true, but you just made a comment about him carrying it a minute ago. So Representative Edwards will carry. I suspect we'll hear from Representative Gilliam and Representative Bailey on the floor. That closes the work session on House Bill 2940 and open. Okay, and open a public hearing on jointly House Bill 3376, 3377, and 3378. Barbara.
3376 allows authorized state agencies to use fuel cell power systems for energy backup power applications and for critical power applications. 3377 provides for a maximum allowable amount of credit for a fuel cell system, other than home builder installed renewable energy system, of 50% of the total certified cost. 3378 authorizes issuance of lottery bonds for grants to agencies in Oregon's executive department and other private companies to acquire fuel cell systems.
Thank you. Looking at the three bills, have the same two people signed up for all three. Eric Simpkins, Doug Riggs, please. And a couple of other people.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us to testify today. We represent the three fuel cell companies in Oregon.
And if you could start with your name, please, just for the record.
I am sorry.
No problem.
For the record, my name is Eric Simpkins. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for IDATEC. And as I was saying, we represent the three fuel cell companies that constitute our industry in Oregon. I'm accompanied by Mr. Burgess and Mr. Nigan today from Hydra Fuel Cell Corporation. ClearEdge is another fuel cell company in Hillsboro. Mr. Sproul could not be with us today and sends his regrets. These bills today support and substantially extend the development of the Oregon fuel cell industry if enacted. Fuel cells, as you may all know, are generation devices, clean power generation devices from a variety of fuels. Today we're considered an alternative form of energy production. In the near future we'll probably be considered also a renewable form of energy production by the use of sustainable fuels. Oregon firms benefit the regional economy. I can speak from my term in 2008. IDATEC was responsible for about $24 million of benefit to the economy through revenue, through salaries, and other benefits. We create jobs. Today, between our three companies, we have on the order of 200 employees. In the next few years, we expect to expand that to thousands of employees. The bills before you directly contribute to jobs growth through mechanisms for market adoption of fuel cell products and extension of the energy tax credit. HB 3376 authorizes agencies to use fuel cells for backup and critical power generation. These would be applied to new state facilities and repowering of existing facilities. It would be done through the comparison of fuel cell technology against other incumbent technologies and the benefits we bring to bear. HB 3377 provides a maximum allowable credit of 50% of the total certified cost of a fuel cell installation. The Business Energy Tax Credit has enabled technology development by our firms that's led to the global sales of commercial power systems. One example I can give, again, from my company, is the establishment of a partnership with companies in India to provide fuel cell systems as backup generating capability for the build-out of their telecom industry. Our contract is to supply 10,000 of our fuel cell power plants. Last year, we supplied 35 fuel cell power plants to a telecom company in Florida, and we thought that was a big deal. 10,000 is huge in our industry. It's the largest in our industry's experience. HB 3378 authorizes the issuance of lottery bonds that would resource grants for purchasing fuel cell systems. This would be jointly managed by the Oregon Department of Energy and the Department of Administrative Services. Our fuel cell businesses provide a significant impact to our regional economy, as I mentioned. I can characterize that a little bit by saying that for every 50 fuel cell power plants that we site, we create approximately 5 direct jobs at our companies and a number of indirect jobs through our suppliers of purchased goods and services. We avoid the air emissions for 50 power plants of equivalent size of coming from incumbent technologies like diesel generating sets and other power technologies. We provide an additional approximately $1.3 million in parts and services, salaries, and tax revenue for each of the 50 power plants that are sold and sited. We understand the financial conditions here merit a critical review of the proposed legislation placed before this committee. We're sensitive to the issues of diminishing revenue, coupled with a significant demand for that revenue. Our industry is a net and a significant contributor to local and state economies, even in financially stressed times. We're producing power products that respond to the global demand and national energy priorities, home by American home. We ask that you consider these legislative proposals in the most favorable ways that will contribute to our local and regional needs. I thank you very much for your time and your consideration of these proposals.
Thank you very much, Mr. Simpkins. Who's next?
We're just in the early stage. My name's Larry Burgess. I'm Director of Engineering Services at Hybrid Fuel Cell. We're in the early development stages. This is the grandfather of our products in the state, so we're...
Doesn't sound like he's accepting that title.
Well, he told me if I said anything, he was going to shoot me, but... The only thing I could say is that for those of you that haven't figured out what a fuel cell is, in the early days it was called a gas battery. So that any place you would have a battery, this would be an excellent replacement. Plus, it's definitely green.
Mr. Chairman, we brought with us today an example of a fuel cell. This is a 250-watt electrical-producing power plant. We give it a liquid fuel, in this particular case, a methanol and water mixture, and it generates 250 watts of electricity. That would be about enough to power the laptops and the lighting in this room. These are used in a whole variety of applications on five continents and in Oceania through our sales with our global partners. The other two fuel cell companies are getting to that same state of affairs.
Glad to hear it.
Any questions, I'd be happy to entertain.
Any questions for Bill? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, just a comment. About 4 years ago, I believe, I had the opportunity to tour the Idatech facility out in Bend and was very impressed by the scale of the operation and the construction jobs that were out there and the innovation. So I'm glad this is a good Oregon company, and I'm sure the others are as well, and I look forward to continued innovation.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just briefly looking at your testimony, and I see that you've got what appears to be quite a business already. You've sold fuel cell power plant systems to India, and so it's this is, how long has this industry been going on, I guess?
Well, this industry was started by a British gentleman in the 1840s, and I remember when I was in college back in the early 70s, I read an article in Popular Mechanics that said in 10 years we'll have fuel cells in all of our homes and all of our cars. Popular Mechanics ran an article about 6 months ago that said in about 10 years we'll have fuel cells in all of our homes and all of our cars. So it's an industry, frankly, that's been around for a while. It's an industry that has struggled. However, with the support of the Oregon legislator and its legislative, and the benefits to the fuel cell companies, we have been able to get past some of the technology hurdles through the completion of some R&D projects. These have contributed to the development of fuel cell products, which we're, as I said, now selling globally.
Follow up. Just a moment. Follow up, then we'll come to you.
In relationship, excuse me, Representative Thatcher, I guess I'm feeling a little wordy at the moment. In relationship to that, I'm kind of curious then what the need for the state to have the to be able to assist with lottery bonds to provide a pilot project, a power fuel cell pilot project. And so I'm wondering, sounds like you're pretty well established, so I'm wondering why the state would need to use lottery bonds to fund a pilot project.
Good question, Representative. Thank you. Currently in the state of Oregon, there are three sited fuel cell systems. There's one with the Oregon State Police at Cape Perpetua and two more with a Bend Broadband in central Oregon. What we need to do, I believe, is to encourage the adoption of fuel cell products. Most people look first at the price of the technology and the life cycle cost of ownership and maintaining it over the life of the power plant. But just as importantly is getting your hands on the device and kicking the tires. And the objective of that piece of legislation is to provide some funding support to state agencies to buy power plants. It could be in a way of paying for the delta between a fuel cell system, which are a little higher priced and are lower production quantities today, and the incumbent technologies that already exist.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. So the lottery bond funds are going to be used by the state agencies to purchase fuel cell systems, or for private industry to purchase fuel cell systems?
It would be for state agencies to purchase these systems.
For state agencies?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Well, the bill actually looks like it says and private companies headquartered in Oregon, but I'm curious about the technology. How much is that little gizmo right there? Just for example, rough estimate.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Oh, I'm just curious how much a gizmo like that would cost, that little fuel cell.
That gizmo today at a unit cost would be in the range of $5,000 to $7,000. In large quantities, it will be substantially lower than that. We're pretty much in the early production phases.
I'm just curious what kind of, you have these smaller type units, and then you have ones that would, I imagine, power entire buildings.
Yeah.
Or
the industry representative markets fuel cell systems that range from providing power for consumer electronics like laptops and cell phones all the way up to the megawatt class facilities that do power small towns and large industries. And it's a good point. We also are, as an industry, although none of our three companies are developing fuel cells for automotive applications, essentially replacing the internal combustion engine.
Thank you.
And we do receive, as an industry, support in a number of other states, Florida, California, New Jersey, Maine, Connecticut, and some others, whereby they do purchase power plant systems by various funding means to provide test articles for field trials.
Appreciate your testimony. We have... Representative
Benz? Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting. We seem to have a energy development device of the day in this legislature. That is, solar maybe is what everyone focuses on for a while, and then we rush over to wind, and then we rush back to biomass, then we rush over to what used to be hydro. So what is it that would prompt us to want to use that type of methodology as opposed to, let's say, solar?
There was a study done by the Department of Energy's laboratory in West Virginia a couple of years ago, and the question asked in that study was, how are we going to meet the demand, the electricity demand of users in the United States and effectively in all of North America by the year 2050, assuming that we build no more nuclear power plants? The director of the National Energy Renewable Laboratory answered that question in two ways, one with nuclear power plants and one without nuclear power plants. And the study conclusion was that regardless of what energy technologies were used, there will not be enough power generated in the United States to serve all of the electric demand. Fuel cells provide another technology for producing electricity, but equally important, they do so with very high efficiency, almost double the efficiency of conventional energy generators, including the grid and diesel gensets and so on, which means we use up to half as much fuel, therefore conserving fuel, and we do so by providing power at the point of need rather than having to have a transmission system to move electrons around the country, and we also do so with almost no emissions. These generation devices are very clean.
Last question, Mr. Chair. I noticed that your House Bill 3376 suggests that the state compare, to the greatest extent practical, that system with others that are available when we're doing work on state buildings. That was the concept underlying this bill.
That's
I understand that correctly.
That's correct.
The idea was then to somehow move us as a state into looking at these types of systems in addition to looking at all others.
That's correct.
And just as a remark, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if we already have that requirement. Obviously, if we don't, we wouldn't have this bill, I suppose. But have you already approached the Department of Energy and asked for that if it is utilizing some sort of a leveling of the playing field effort at the department level as opposed to coming and asking for us to do it through this bill?
We've had that discussion with the director of ODOE, Mike Graney, and he supports this bill as he supports all three pieces of legislation. The if a state agency compares technologies, they don't, to my understanding, do it to an established set of criteria that would be approved, in this particular case, jointly by the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Energy. So it would be a requirement in this bill to establish that criteria and to report back to this committee and others as necessary on the results of that work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are fast approaching the end of our time, and I know Representative Wisnett wants to be heard, so I hope you'll be okay with us asking him to come forward.
Thank you
very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Representative Gene Wisnett, House District 53. We're recording this, right? So I'm here for an environmental bill. I need help. We need help. You've heard testimony, and you're familiar with what we're talking about here, Mr. Chair, and I just wish there was some way we could keep this alive. I don't know if we've looked at federal stimulus money or however we could use something that to keep this alive. As you know, I come to you from a beautiful area, but it's also 16% unemployment in Deschutes, 18% in Jefferson, and 20% in Crook County. And this is an opportunity to really develop an industry and let Oregon, Central Oregon, be a front runner in this, if we could find some way to keep this alive, or whatever, if the chair has any ideas, or I understand you're concerned about the revenue, but I don't know if, you know, we can move it and see if we can find some, if there's any federal stimulus money or that would look at this. Energy tax credits. I'm not an expert in this. It's a business that, you know, that started a few years ago in Central Oregon, and I still think it has a lot of potential and could create a lot of jobs, good, clean jobs and family wage jobs in Central Oregon. If there's anything the chair of the committee could do to help us keep it alive.
Appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions or comments? Let's see. Thank you very much for leaving the judiciary for coming.
Okay, Mr. Chair, so there's no way to do a work session to send it to Ways and Means to see if there could be some money?
I don't believe so. I'm definitely sensitive to the concerns and appreciate the work that the innovative companies are doing, but I'm getting the sense that this bill is these bills are likely to suffer, if they leave this committee, are likely to suffer a more drawn out demise. So I hope that we can work on them in the interim and perhaps find the support for them in the next session.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, any other comments? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3376, 77, and 78, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2647.
HB 2647 changes sunset date for a utility public purpose charge from 2026 to 2012.
We have four people signed up to testify, so I hope that we can do that in the short remaining time. John Charles, David Busios, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and then I'll call Jeff Bissonnette and Suzanne Lidaloo after these gentlemen are finished. And if you could keep your comments to a couple minutes, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know it's not an auspicious time to take up a new subject, so I'll be brief. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. This bill does one thing. It changes the sunset date for the pump for purpose charge from 2026 back to 2012. And for those of you who are not fishing autos of pump for purpose charge, 2012 was actually the original sunset date. That charge, 3% charge, was created in Senate Bill 1149, passed in 1999, a very complex bill. And the charge is to be used for new cost-effective local energy conservation and new market transformation efforts and the above-market cost of new renewable energy resources, along with low-income weatherization. The Energy Trust of Oregon was established right after that, and they received 73.4% of the public purpose funds. Now, the amount of money we're talking about here is substantial. It was $47 million in 2003. It was $65 million in public purpose funds in 2008, and projected to be $71.4 million in 2009. At the time it was enacted, it was to be a 10-year subsidy stream to kickstart these renewable energy and energy conservation programs. There was a whole work group, and Ron Ekus, then chair of the PUC, speaking for the work group, said at the time, 10 years provides both an assurance of funding and provides some stability, and at the same time provides an opportunity for a competitive market to develop. So that was the thinking in 1999, was if we have a 10-year revenue stream, then at the end of the, which was started in 2002 to sunset February 28th of 2012, then these birds would get out of the nest and fly on their own. I wasn't part of that negotiation, but I'm fine with it. I wish it had been kept. But last session in Senate Bill 838, the RPS bill, this was extended to 2026. Well, there was almost no discussion of that. I testified many times on the bill. I attended almost every hearing. It was never discussed. It was buried on page 18 of a long, complex bill. And moving forward, you're talking about at least $1 billion of ratepayer money that's not really very accountable. And I just think that before we get to that point of 2012, somebody needs to do some due diligence. I mean, someone in this building, about where is the money going, who's spending it, what are we getting for it, and especially now that we have an RPS mandate anyway, whether it's even relevant anymore. So I know that it's never sort of the right time to talk about a revenue stream. And certainly today, I guess, is not the right time. But because all the proponents of extending it, they always are proponents of extending it. The people paying it are hardly ever here to defend themselves. And I think my preference would be, since this has a subsequent referral to revenue, and three of you are on the revenue committee, it'd be great to get it down there for further discussion. If not, I hope it could be taken up in the interim, and that we could really look at what point do we finally end these subsidy programs, because if we don't have the discussion, the subsidy programs will never end.
Thank you, Mr. Charles.
Hello, my name is David Becerros. I submitted some written testimony. I'd kind of more briefly like to talk about more of the policy behind some of the issues. I mean, it is a 10-year plan, and it was intended to begin small and then let the market kind of blossom with it and let it grow into what could potentially be more effective than just the subsidy. However, What the ETO has done with this money has really not done much. Their biggest efforts is to change the market and put money and use these subsidies to create more investment and create more energy efficiency. However, it's kind of like throwing pebbles at a wall. And when you're only subsidizing and providing incentives to individuals and companies, it only affects those individuals and companies who receive those incentives. They may become more energy efficient, and there might be some societal benefit, but it really doesn't ever change the market. And once those subsidies are gone, even if you were to extend it to 2025, it would just die then too. But it's not, the real effects in the markets can be seen with hybrid cars of today. They've had significant advances separate from many subsidies. They do provide some subsidies for them, but we see all these efforts and all these advances in these technologies separate from the subsidies. We don't need public money to finance these projects. With these, I'd also like to speak on the renewable energy aspect of the ETO. With this new RPS standard with 838, utilities are required to come up with 25% of their energy from renewable projects. These utilities have the best advantage of taking economies of scale. They have They can produce the wind farms that are much larger than any individual house can ever put on a solar panel. This money is just being misused. If the state was really concerned with becoming 25% renewable, it should not be focusing on this small scale by providing incentives to local households. They really should be affecting large-scale projects out in wherever. So I'd like to... My testimony has some more comments. I'd like to just briefly say that returning it back to the sunset date is not giving up on this technology. It's not doing anything to the programs. It's simply just bringing it back, holding the people accountable, and letting it chance. If this market is going to grow, it's going to grow in 2012. It's not going to, extending it 13 more years is not going to change how it grows.
Thank you, Mr. Macias. Any quick questions? We have two more people and not many more minutes. Thank you very much. Jeff Fisnett, Suzanne Lee Liu, please. Lee Liu, would you like to start?
Be happy to, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Reed. My name is Suzanne Lita Liu. I'm the Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project. I am a member of the Energy Trust of Oregon's Renewable Energy Advisory Committee, the RAC. So we actually, they have monthly meetings to track very closely the spending of the public purpose charge. One thing that is unique about the public purpose charge is that the money goes toward the above market costs of new technologies. It does not support any longer projects that are cost competitive. And one other thing that's unique is that the money that's spent is spent very, very well, and it continues to change to match new technologies. That's one of the benefits of having the program go out into 2026. That's one of the reasons why we made that change within the RPS, is so that that money could be available to change as technologies changed over time. Finally, I would just say that, so just to be clear, we do oppose this particular bill for those reasons. And the final reason is that, as we stated before, the RPS was a highly negotiated piece of legislation with the governor's office, utilities, public utility commission, citizens groups, consumer groups, and we would certainly not recommend legislation to amend that bill in the current session. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. Suzanne Lita Liu just talked a little bit about the renewables part. I will add to that briefly that the major policy change that Senate Bill 838, the Renewable Energy Standard, made was, and the expectation after the passage was that a lot of the utility investment in renewables is going to go after large wind. Prior to the passage of 838, the public purpose charge contributed to all renewables, large, small, and in between. With the passage of Senate Bill 838, the public purpose charge was refocused to cover small-scale renewables because the utilities were going to be meeting the initial parts of the RPS with large-scale wind, and the focusing of the public purpose charge, of the renewable part of the public purpose charge, on small-scale resources indeed focuses those resources and helps industries, smaller industries like solar, like wave, develop and hopefully one day play a larger part in supporting the renewable energy standard. I also want to just take a brief moment to say that the vast majority of the public purpose charge, both that the Energy Trust of Oregon does not administer and that portion that it does administer, goes to energy efficiency. And energy efficiency is by far the most economical and cheapest resource that we have. And so we always need that investment, and one of the things that we did with the public purpose charge is maintain a a consistent amount over a long period of time. Prior to the establishment of the public purpose charge, we saw wild swings up and down of investment in energy efficiency. And so what we have is now an energy efficiency industry and customers that can depend on a steady stream of dollars going to energy efficiency. And with the price that we've seen with energy costs over the last several years, I think we can definitely say that 3% is not enough. But 3% is what we have, and the Energy Trust is doing a good job administering that with a lot of accountability, a lot of oversight from the Public Utility Commission. I'd invite you to go to the Energy Trust website at energytrust.org, and you can see all of their materials basically from today on back to when they first opened their doors in 2002. Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bisnett. We have a very short time. I don't see anyone who is eagerly seeking recognition for the purpose of questions, so appreciate you being here. Thanks for starting the discussion. We're very nearly out of time. We did receive several pieces of testimony, written testimony. I forgot to acknowledge as we were going through the various bills. They're in front of you, so we'll note that for the record. Before I drop the gavel, I just want to make sure we triple check that I'm not forgetting anything. Look at you, Terry.
Okay.
All good?
Yeah.
Everything?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. Close the public hearing on. Forgotten the bill number now. We've gone through so many.
2647.
On the closed public hearing on House Bill 2647, and momentous occasion, we'll adjourn the committee.
Oh, you are? Okay.